I'm talking to Bridget Noonan, who's one of the co-conveners of the Women, Earth and Change Network, which organises the Women, Earth and Change Conference, just a new conference organised for eco-feminist activists all over Australia. So, Bridget, you call yourself an eco-feminist?
Yeah, I do.
Why do you call yourself an eco-feminist?
I call myself an eco-feminist because I have a particular political perspective and a particular way of going about my activism that's about making connections between the women's movement, the environmental movement, and other broader movements like economic justice and human rights. And I see the connections between a lot of movements that are often seen as single-issue movements, and that kind of holistic perspective is something that I feel an affinity with, and I feel that that's embodied in the term ecofeminism.
So you see that both environmental issues and feminist issues are intimately connected, is that what you're saying?
Yes, I do, yes.
Can you give us some examples of how the sort of stuff that you do shows those connections?
I've been involved in the Irrity Wanty campaign as an example, which is the campaign to stop the nuclear waste dump out in South Australia, mm-hmm. which is being organised by a group of older Aboriginal women. And I think that that campaign exemplifies a lot of the concerns of ecofeminism, of making the connections between the welfare of Indigenous people who live a lifestyle that's quite connected to the environment that they live in, the land that is their home.
Mm-hmm.
And it also highlights the welfare of women who are often in a position where they're the ones that are concerned about the environment and the impacts that it has on their children and the ongoing future of their family, more so than men tend to be, although it's not always the case, but it seems to be a trend that happens in the world. And, of course, you know, there's the whole environmental issue of the nuclear industry and the effects of uranium once it's dug up. And what do you do with waste and then putting it in an area that is considered deserted when actually it's a special area for Aboriginal people in Australia, and that whole sort of colonial perspective that there are places in a country that are abandoned or considered wastelands doesn't acknowledge that all land has worth and has intrinsic value because it exists.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it's being industrialised or used for businesses isn't the only measure of the worth of natural land.
So the Irrawaddy campaign, that it's being organised by the Indigenous women, is that right?
Yes.
And so you're forming a support role in that. Do you think it's very important for white feminists, white middle-class feminists like us, to support disadvantaged groups like Indigenous people as much as we can?
Yeah, I do. I think it's really important for like women who identify as feminists to recognise that a lot of the particularly mainstream feminist movement has not really been about looking at the experiences of the most marginalised women.
Yeah.
And it tends to have been a movement to promote middle-class white women to advance in sort of capitalist society, and that the needs that are promoted in that movement are not the needs of like a whole range of women who fall outside of those experiences. And I think if feminism and the women's movement is going to be a progressive movement to liberate all women, then it needs to be able to encompass the needs of a whole range of women and not say that some women are more important than other women or are more valid as women, which tends to, I think, be the intersection where race comes into play. And I think, you know, I think white feminism has been very racist in its history, and I really do think that white feminism has a lot to learn from the feminist movements of women of colour, of nurse women, because they're really radical. You know, they're raising issues that are very complex. They're beneficial for all Australians, for all people, men and women, to consider and to think about what they mean for the future, like, of the whole country.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there the effects that capitalism has, particularly on disadvantaged groups like Indigenous people, but also on women. Would you say that is the way that feminism links to environmentalism, because capitalism affects the environment just as badly as it does human and social justice issues?
Yeah, I mean, definitely I think that capitalism, and I would say patriarchal capitalism, because I think capitalism is a gendered ideology, I think that it has a very similar attitude of exploitation towards the natural environment, you know, towards forests, towards desert land, towards rivers, towards animals, as it does have towards particular sections of community that have been used as natural resources, mm-hmm. which unfortunately has been Indigenous people. It's often been women who have been kept in roles of housewives, of, you know, producing the next generation without actually having opportunities to economically participate. And, you know, and I think children are involved in that too. I think children often get exploited a lot in our society as well, and not seen as having their own intrinsic value because they're alive, you know, not just because they're not able to produce or to go out and work, therefore they shouldn't have the same rights as adults. And I think there's a whole ideology there of valuing people only with how can contribute to the dominant patriarchal capitalist sort of work environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's been a really sort of malevolent force towards, you know, a whole lot of people in society who feel, you know, they don't identify with that particular way of living.
Can I just play the devil's advocate for a minute here?
Yes.
I know this comes up a lot for me, and it probably does for you. The idea that capitalism is patriarchal. How do you defend that?
How do I defend it?
Yes.
I guess, like, it's very obvious when you look at people who are in positions of power, people who are running corporations, people who are involved in high levels of government are predominantly men. Like, you know, very much so, those areas are dominated by men. And I think that that's an historical thing. And it's, interestingly enough, something that more middle-class white feminisms are trying to focus on is actually channeling more women into those areas.
So the idea that, well, that's one of the aims of the first wave of feminism is to give women equal economic rights to men.
Yes.
But that means buying into this capitalist, exploitative, dominating kind of system. What ways can you see that eco-feminists want to undo that?
Well, I think one of the reasons why I like eco-feminism is because it fundamentally challenges all these assumptions that we're saying of feminism, that women will be better off and will be more equal when we are equally participating in a system of patriarchal capitalism. And ecofeminism says, well, no, actually, we think that the whole system is faulty. Mm. Like the way that multinational corporations run themselves, the way that economics generally conducts itself in the world is fundamentally exploitative. And just getting women into positions of power within that structure is not going to be a movement of liberation. And because of that, like, I feel an affinity with ecofeminism because I like the way that it just tries to challenge the root of that no, we need to change the entire structure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, none of this sort of smoke screen of, like, yeah, like, women will get co-opted into the system when people can point to the successful women when there's 50% white feminist CEOs in multinational companies that suddenly, like, women are liberated. It's not, well, actually, the behaviour and activities of those companies is exploiting a whole nother range of women in the world, and, you know, that's not okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that probably brings us to one of the solutions that ecofeminists have come up with a way to solve both feminist issues and ecological issues, and that is the idea of an ethic of care, that our ethic towards other human beings and the environment should be one where we show that we care about them, and that a lack of care, as exampled by measuring everything by economic value, is endemic in our system and we have to deal with that. What does an ethic of care mean for you?
Yeah, I mean, I like the concept of ethic of care. I think that it's important to define. It probably, you know, the understanding of what care means probably is very diverse, depending on sort of what subculture that you exist in. I find it important because I think that to have a holistic perspective of human reality and of the needs of people, you have to be able to take into account what people need in their personal lives, the kind of things that the sustenance that people need in their interpersonal relationships, the importance of having a good relationship with the environment around you, being able to treat animals with respect, being able to treat children with respect,
mm-hmm.
And that you don't have to put that aside to be able to function in, say, a business world or out in the world in a professional workplace, that there needs to be an integration where you can take the same caring that you need to nurture within a family unit into the workplace, and that a workplace should actually embody some of those values, like in the way that it practices. And that there's traditionally been this real split where when you go into a workplace or, you know, into a business, you discard all of those ethics of care that have been relegated to the private sphere of the family, and that you're not allowed to bring them into your workplaces. You know, you're not allowed to be caring. You're not allowed to be compassionate. You have to be professional. And being professional means that you have to be rational and objective. And frankly, it's quite often very uncaring. And I think that, you know, you can make connections with that, with how workplaces have been dominated by men and men's culture for, you know, as long as capitalism's been around, because women were shut out from the workplace for so long. And unfortunately, a lot of those sort of really important values around being compassionate, being nurturing, being caring, have been really let out of a whole section of society. And there needs to be more of a sort of holistic integration.
So in a way, the Ethic of Care project is about reformulating what it means to be a human being. Is that what you'd say it would be?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, I think it's about what it means to be a human being. It's about, you know, it's ethics. It's in the realm of ethics around how you treat other people, how you relate to your natural environment. And not just that, but how do you negotiate the complexities of enacting those ethics throughout your whole life so that you don't just leave certain things at the door when you walk into your workplace or when you walk into a business or when, you know, you go shopping and you sort of use like 10 plastic bags to take your shopping home, but then you go home and you really worry about your kid maybe eating food that might have chemicals in it.
Yeah.
You know, and just the way that I don't blame individuals for those kind of behaviours because they're just systemic in our culture, but the way that things have been split off so that it's really difficult for people to have an ethic of care throughout their lives because it's not supported by the culture.
That leads me into my next question. How do you incorporate the idea of care into your activism?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And for me, it's an ongoing process. Like, it's something that I feel that I'm trying to learn how to do because I recognise that, you know, I'm a white woman that grew up in a culture, a Western culture, that doesn't automatically teach people to be ethical and respectful towards life.
Mm.
So for me, it's a process of relearning and of challenging myself and trying to challenge the culture that I'm in about how you would go about doing that. And I guess at some practical levels, like I try through my activism to be fair-minded. I try and be aware of when I'm enacting practices that might be racist or might be sexist or might be homophobic, and I try and be aware when those dynamics come into groups that I'm involved with or when people express opinions that might be offensive towards people. Like, I try and remember what my ethics are, and I try and speak up about that and say, no, actually, we're just acting out something there that's not about what we want to do, and we need to challenge that, and we need to look at other ways of understanding this situation or understanding those people that we're trying to work with.
I remember seeing you talk, and you sang a song as well, at the Students of Sustainability Conference in Newcastle a few years ago. And before you started playing, you talked about how you were admitting that you had learnt racist things in your past, and how confronting that was, and how you were going to deal with it. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you came to that realisation?
I think I've learnt a lot about the racism that I have learnt through my life as a white person through being involved in the Indigenous rights movement.
Mm.
And I feel that when you spend time around people who are living a very different culture and are really suffering because of it, you know, because their culture is so marginalised, as Aboriginal people's culture is so marginalised in Australia, and to be around people and to see their daily struggles and to hear about the generations of oppression that families have been through, I mean, it confronts you to go, well, I've been involved in that as a white Australian. Like, I'm involved in that legacy of oppression that's happened.
Mm.
And I feel that it's important for white people to engage with the Indigenous rights movement and to take on the criticisms that Aboriginal people say, because Aboriginal people are highly critical of the culture of white people and the systems of governments here, and so they should be because they've been incredibly oppressed by it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel that it's really important for white people to do work themselves away from Aboriginal people, you know, to get together and have discussions, open discussions about our understandings of racism, about things that maybe we've done or maybe we know that our family has done in other generations, and making connections between personal practices and government policies, and doing that educational work so that when we interact with Aboriginal people, we're not putting them in a role where they have to educate us about our own problems.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, we're talking about a more open way of dialoguing with other people that aren't like us, so perhaps improving democracy.
I guess it's improving. I mean, I'd like to think it's improving democracy. I mean, I'm someone who works at a grassroots level, and I think that the grassroots is always more radical than, like, other levels of governance, and necessarily so, you know. I mean, the anarchy of the grassroots movement is really its power. You know, that people have the space to be able to behave differently, to be able to express radical ideas, and it often takes quite a long time for those ideas to filter through to government levels and then to be enacted through social policy. And, you know, there's a process of change there that needs to be respected, even though as an activist I get really frustrated with how slow, you know, social change can be.
Yeah.
But, well, you know, I mean, that's the way. Like, if you look at at the personal process of change of an individual, it often takes people a long time to come to terms with new ideas.
That's what you've been saying about, yeah, what's happened with you. Because we're trying to be more open to other people's points of view, that's a very emotionally draining and physically exhausting kind of way to live. How do you care for yourself?
Well, I think that's really interesting, because I think that it can be emotionally draining, but I also think that it's uplifting as well.
Mm.
You know, like, I don't think that learning to have compassion for perspectives that are different to our own is always just a negative thing. Like, it's a highly beneficial process. But I also recognise that when you're doing work that is often under-supported by society and often really underpaid,
yeah,
like, it is draining, you know. And often, because women particularly, they have so many other things going on in their lives, like, we have so many responsibilities that, yeah, you definitely have to be able to develop skills to look after your own body and mind and spirit in that process. And I think that that's something that I've been very much learning how to do over my whole 20s. And I think some of the things that I do, I guess at a personal level, is I try and really be aware of my energy levels. And, you know, if I'm involved in an action group or a campaign and I really feel like I'm starting to get quite negative and quite tired all the time, then I'll negotiate with myself and I'll negotiate with the people around me to be able to withdraw from my responsibilities for a certain amount of time so that I can recuperate and do things that I need to do to start feeling stronger. And then I'll go back into the work when I feel that I have the energy to do the work.
Part of that is also perceiving that happening in other people. Do you think that that's a real skill that people need to learn, especially in grassroots activism?
Yeah, I do. You know, I really think that sometimes, and I've been in campaign situations where things can get really sabotaged by people who are burning out and they're not aware that they're doing that. And they become quite negative and quite sabotaging of what other people are doing, and often unintentionally so, because they probably care very much about the issues that they're working on. But when people burn out, they're not effective workers, and it's really in the best interest of the work that they're doing that they take some time out and they do whatever they need to do to replenish their energies and to work on, you know, getting their sort of attitude back into a positive state of mind. And then, you know, re-enter the work and really bring your passion with you.
One of the exhausting things that you've been doing in the last 2 years is organising the Women Earth and Change Network.
Yes.
Can you tell us about some of the good things that have come out of that?
Yeah, it's been a really interesting process of this network and the conference that they supported by that network. Some of the good things that we're working on at the moment is we've had some women from East Timor who have come to the last two conferences who have spoken about struggles of people generally in East Timor since they're trying to rebuild their whole country after the Indonesian withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I'm doing is I'm working with some women in the Blue Mountains and also a woman who works with the East Timor women in the Northern Rivers area, And we're trying to set up some support groups to be able to raise money to send them over to Bevis Choir in East Timor to support women in finishing their education, mm-hmm. in running things like computer courses, where this organisation, this women's organisation, they have a few computers and they want to teach women some basic computer skills so they can run small businesses. And they don't have the resources to be able to do it.
Yeah.
There's also women who, before the post-ballot violence, started university degrees. And since the country collapsed and the currency collapsed, and there's just been a whole lot of issues, like the national language has changed, national currency has changed, people haven't been able to resume their education.
Mm.
So we're trying to set up a sort of sponsorship program where people can sponsor individual women with helping them get through their university degrees. And also another thing that we're going to try and help them with is there's a lot of women in the villages in East Timor that make these beautiful woven cloths.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very highly skilled at this weaving that they do, but they don't have markets to sell their cloth in. So we're going to try and find some places in Australia where these women can sell their cloths and the money can go straight back into the villages where they can use it to pay for their health and education and, you know, the kind of development that they need.
That sounds like a fantastic project. If women listening to this would like to get involved in helping you out with that, can they contact you somehow?
Yeah, they can. They can email the network, which is conference@womenandearth.org, and all of our contact details actually are on our website, which is probably the best port of call. It's www.womenandearth.org.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell me about while we're here?
Well, I'd like to tell you about the Change for the Record CD that a woman involved in our network, Sarah Davis, she has skills around producing music,
mm-hmm.
and she initiated this project of recording grassroots women activists who haven't had any experience with recording their music. And during the 3 days of the conference, she recorded about 8 tracks of women singing their songs. And we also got some other submissions from women who had already recorded some of their music and they've put their tracks in. And at the moment, she's mixing and mastering that CD, and it should be available for people to listen to probably from early February next year. And that will all be on our website as well.
That sounds brilliant. And next year, there's going to be another Women, Earth and Change conference?
Yeah, we're negotiating around when the conference is going to be. So I can't tell you the exact dates at the moment, but there will be another conference and we will be promoting it, and hopefully people will see our promotion when it comes up.